Now I give you the opportunity to ask questions or anything you want to discuss. Feel free to do so. Yes?
Please, could I ask, you've never been a woman, so how do you know that a woman's consciousness is the same as a man's consciousness? It's a basic idea.
Well, it has to be the same, because it's not a, you know, consciousness is what goes in consciousness, you know, would be different. So you know, this is just a way of exploring experience. You know, I can't say, you know, how a woman should feel, and if you have a woman's body, you know, the kind of feelings that you have from it, and the kind of I can't relate to that. You know, I can relate to it as on a human level, we share a common humanity, male and female, but then the bodies have their own energies, you know, that are different. So I can't speak from that, but from having a woman's body. But if we recognize consciousness as unitive, then the female male thing is recognized, but it's not consciousness. I mean, like, femininity isn't consciousness. Femininity, the sense of being of physical, like physical feelings that women have or men have. They come and go and change. The identity of being, you know, being male or female comes and goes. But the consciousness has no quality to it other than knowing. So I can only know this for myself. Now, I just assume that women, someone who has a female body can do it too. And they do, you know. But, you know, being male or female is a very strong identity. And notice what strong identities are, you know, like obsessions around sexuality. Strong, like homosexuality, things like that. A very strong identity with that perception. Or with being Jewish, or, you know, being that's a very strong identity with some kind of past history and identity on in terms of race or religion, and then one fights for these things, will die for these things, see everything that doesn't quite, that is its opposite, as an enemy, as a threat. And that's the dukkha that's created through that attachment. So the conditions are not to be they're not the problem, really. It's the blind attachment to them that creates the suffering. Like race prejudice, things like racial prejudice. That's conditioned. That's not natural, you know, in terms of we're not born. I wasn't born thinking I'm a white man. That's an identity, you know, that was I picked up. And then the way that one looks at other ethnic groups or races is cultural, you know, and class identities are very strong. Here in Britain, very strong. Much in the Americans, we don't, they're not, they're more kind of amorphous. You know, when I first came to live here, I was talking about the middle class, I was speaking from an American perspective, and I was getting it all wrong, because American middle class includes almost everybody. This is kind of generic. Well, here you have upper middle, lower middle, working class. Much more refined sense of social identity. But that's conditioned too. It's not ultimately true. And yet these identities can really, you know, how we see ourselves, you know, if you're, you know, you see yourself as inferior, you know, you're a second class citizen, how that must feel. I know, being, you know, from my background, where in the States, I'm from the kind of what they call the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Now that's the kind of racial identity that is the kind of that gives you complete confidence on that level. And even though, you know, as I grew older and became aware of the racial prejudices and the snobbery and the arrogance of that, still, because of having that conditioning, there's a certain kind of confidence. I'm never, I don't understand racial prejudice from experience. Because even if I go to another country where they hate white people, it isn't, you know, I can understand that. But it isn't forming, and it doesn't ruin the sense of myself, you know. So it's a kind of arrogance, that an assumption that, you know, that you're, you know, not, it's not even conscious. It's assumed oftentimes that you, you know, you don't have that sense of being racially inferior. But you talk to, like, in the States, American blacks. Now they're brought up with the assumption that they're inferior to the whites. Even though they might say they're just as good or better, but it's more like defensiveness. Now that's because of the culture there, that they are actually regarded in that way. Even ideally, that's not supposed to be the way it is. Well, you know, I can't relate to that on that level. I can, on a personal level, I can relate to feeling inferior and not as good as. So I've had to explore my sense of inferiority, not being as good as, from personal identities, you know, comparing myself to people who I thought are better or more intelligent or more gifted or more superior, which hasn't to do with, well, nothing to do with race, but with more like personal identity. So, and like being Jewish, I don't understand that, because I don't have any strong identity in that way. Like, I was brought up as a Christian, but it doesn't mean much to me. It's nothing I'd die for. In fact, I'm a Buddhist now. or being American or anything. It doesn't. Those aren't strong, identities with me. But then living with people that have very strong fixed identities, you know, I find it sometimes difficult to understand the problem from my own experience of life. I was never like abused as a child, you know, like sexually abused or mistreated. So I can, you know, I can sympathize with people, but I don't know what it's really like to be raped when you're 4 years old or something, what that does. You know, I mean, I can understand that would be traumatic, but in terms of my own experience, I don't, you know, I don't have, that didn't happen, so I don't have that, you know, I don't, you know, what that really, how that affects your self-identity. I can understand what somebody else is saying, but in terms of experience myself, I don't have that. But this is where the common bond of suffering is not defined in, you know, as being, you know, sexual abuse when you're 3 or 4 years old, or, and it's not pointed at any particular kind of suffering, but just the reality of when there's this ignorance of Dhamma, even with the advantages, you know, having an advantage life, still is suffering. You know, you still feel something meaning, life is meaningless. Like I find materialism, the way, you know, when I was in, you know, in university, I just felt how meaningless the life was then, the American materialism. You know, and it was, you know, certainly comfortable and certainly had its pleasures. But in terms of just thinking, just getting more and more material things, I could see that it seemed empty and meaningless. Because I could observe whenever I got what I wanted, you know, then I'd want something else. And it just, you know, you can't sustain the satisfaction you get. The satisfaction you have from getting what you want. It's just momentary, you're kind of gratified, and then you want something else. And it goes on and on and on like that. So there's an awareness of just how, what's the point of just getting more and more, because you're always left with this wanting something else, and it never resolves itself.
One of the important things is actual social context, that you're born into a social context. And the things that you, one of the things you require is language. And one of the things that you said is that there's thought before language. But I wonder if you're requiring language, how do you know that there's thought without language? If it's something you're born into, isn't that then preconditioning? And then if you're born as a man or a woman, and the terms and the language that you then acquire, how does one ever know what an unconditioned state is?
Well, it's like that you have to just let go of your doubts and your questions. Like language is like, you know, we acquire language after we're born. We're not born with any identity. You know, I don't think I'm a little boy and I'm an American. These concepts were given to me after I was born. And then they're told little boys are like this and little girls are like that, and how a good boy should be like this, obey his mommy and daddy and so forth, and bad boys don't. And you get the reward punishment of conditioning. And so your identity of being a good boy or bad boy, and then your way you relate to your parents and how they see you and their, you know, so it all has its effect, and the sense of your self-worth is, developed from that. So, you know, when you, and then you know whether you're tall or short. These are, you know, when you're a teenager, these are very important. Either fat or thin. What if you're dark or light? These things all, you know, have values on them in different social situations. And so, you know, if you're short and fat, then you tend to be, you know, you experience a sense and people make fun of you or insult you and things like this. So then you that affects. So then your sense of your self-worth is created from that, you know. So people, that's why people have so many neuroses, you know. Because of these basic identities, you acquire it. You don't intentionally do it; it just happens in the society, in the family, in the society that you find yourself in. Now in the Buddhist concept of karma, I find that sometimes that's the only way to explain it, and because you know, I used to, when you're self-critical, then you think, why do I have to be like this? You know, why couldn't I be different? Why couldn't, you know, and think of some ideal of what I'd like to be. And it's not fair. You know, when I was a child, you know, growing up in the Christian religion, you know, and this idea that God created everyone. And then I kept thinking, but it's not fair. You know, why do you create some short and fat and some rich and poor, beautiful and ugly? And why, you know, if why it's not fair to give some people all, you know, rich and beautiful and privileged and all the best, and others, you know, beggars on the street and, you know, no status. You know, to the to idealism, it's unfair. And then so you try to why did, if we only have this one lifetime, and we're you know, why didn't we all have the same? Why don't we all look the same? Have the same beauty and the same talent? You know, that's a reasonable mind, idea of how it should be. And if God were a loving God, he wouldn't have created poor people that were ugly and stupid and that. He wouldn't have done that. Or rich people who are ugly and stupid. He just wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. I would go. So how do you explain it? And then, because of like Buddhism doesn't give you a way of working with that problem. You know, like it's karma. So in some way, I find that oftentimes karma is seen as kind of fate or. You know, it can be seen in just kind of like fatalistic and just a way of kind of resigning yourself to misery. Say, it's my karma. But, and that's not reflective. But also maybe it's easier, it makes life easier to, it's my karma, then it's not fair and I'm, you know, hate God and everybody because I didn't get a good deal in this life. But, you know, when, like in meditation, encouraging people, you know, the way that one is, this is what we learn from. You're not going to learn from the way somebody else is. You have to learn, like, whatever your karma is, you know, you learn from this, from the way your personality is, from your experience, your memories, your physical realities and so forth are like this. And then that seems like I can do that. You know, I'm not saying you don't have to have the best equipment. Whatever it is, that's what you learn from. So then this gives a chance for all of us, you know, an equal chance to awaken to it. And sometimes, you know, I've known people who have, you know, physically disabled and really, in terms of having all the advantages, don't have many at all. But because of their disabilities and the pain and things like this, they really awaken. You know, so sometimes it's, you know, you can almost see it as a blessing. You know, sometimes tragedy and illness and disability can be seen, you know, it makes us pay attention. You know, for the way, if you've got a life too easy, you're wealthy and healthy and good-looking and you can just, you know, the world is my oyster, you can just float along and not bother. So even though you might say it's good karma, it might not make you any the wiser. So, I mean, it's like the... like it's dukkha is the actual, you know, the noble truth that awakens us. And people ask me, why did you become a Buddhist monk? It's because of suffering. And my suffering wasn't because I felt mistreated or, you know, that I've had a particularly difficult life, it just seemed, by the time I was 30, I was fed up with life. And it was due to my own conditioning. I could see it just the way I saw it. I had a habitual way of projecting onto experience all kinds of delusions. And it was habitual. It wasn't, I didn't intend to do it. It's just the way that conditioning worked. And so by the time I was 30, I was really weary and bored with life. And I didn't think of, I didn't have an ambition, didn't want to become president of the United States or anything. But then it was, it's kind of, Buddhism was the only thing I found interesting at that time. The only thing that, it was like the light at the end of the tunnel, the only hope I had. And it wasn't because I'd been treated badly. It's the way my conditioning operated that created this sense of weariness. And now I see it as a blessing. Because when I became a monk, then all kinds of things opened up for me that I'd never expected, never would have expected to happen. Yes?
Thank you. I find I feel great attachment to the things like soul and heritage and things, and no matter what belief system I try or practice, there's certain obstacles that come up which bring up anger and conflict within those areas of senses of injustice. And I can see the sense of injustice in me, and the anger in me rather, coming from it. But it doesn't seem to stop. It doesn't seem to stop that closing down of spirit and all that resolution about those issues. And I hope that makes some sense. I'm through meditation and in action, I still find these conflicts quite strong. I feel it's a hindrance, but yet it's a strong belief in some way.
Yeah, well, like the righteous indignation.
Yeah, something like that.
Is very strong emotion.
Yeah, I recognize it as righteous and still, and I recognize it as a hindrance, but it's still very strong.
Well, it is. It's a powerful emotion. and you're right. And that's where... But then, like I was saying about the Middle East, both sides feel they're right. And both come from righteous indignation, and then who's right? And both believe God is on their side. And the Americans think, George Bush said God is on his side, and so. And Osama bin Laden, I sure feels God is on his side. So, who's right? And then you might be thinking, well, because I'm a Westerner, I'm an American, I should, support the West. And that's another conditioning, of identification. But this can't be resolved because, it just gets into wrangling and arguments and power struggling. But then there can be, righteous indignation can be skillfully used when you see unfairness or something that you can actually, do, or when there's opportunities, then one acts accordingly, to what is good, what is appropriate. But it doesn't become a kind of blindness to reality, but it's learning to, like, our emotions aren't you know, not anything to judge or suppress, but to recognize. And so righteous indignation can be, you know, comes from, you know, can be a very good, you know, sense of justice and fairness, and the feeling of being right. And maybe you are right. But then in terms of Dhamma, in Dhamma, you know, then you're seen right as a condition changing rather than some kind of absolute right. And then more and more as you let go, it's just a blind attachment to righteousness that's the problem, not righteousness itself. Then you're informing yourself with wisdom rather than just reacting to injustice through being averse to it and getting angry and wanting to, you know, destroy the people who you feel are wrong. That's an important one, because at a lot of that I can be very righteous, and it's a very energizing emotion. You know, you feel it gets you out of depression. You know, so you get depressed, and then you hear something, you know, about some terrible thing, that the government's doing, or something, you know, Tony Blair said, or something. you feel alive again. But where does it end? You know, just it's you know. But that's what I mean. It's not to despise or criticize righteous indignation. I think it's you know, you shouldn't feel that way. But it's blindness to it that is the problem. Blind attachment. So that's where this waking up, this sense of attention, mindfulness is the only way that we can begin to understand it. And then if we don't, then we tend to react. You know, either we suppress it or follow it. Maybe we depend on it. Some people just wind themselves up endlessly with righteous causes because that's the only way they feel alive and that they have any purpose. Sometimes, you know, sometimes the way I talk or the way it sounds, it might sound like I'm being too passive. You just sit there and watching the righteous indignation. That's not it. It's just to, you know, and then you just kind of sit there all day and don't do anything. But it's not like that. You know, life always gives us, you know, our karma gives us opportunity to help the society, to function in the world as a benevolent member of society, useful member of society. And yet, you know, so it's not just a passive kind of watching, witnessing, and just kind of indifference to it all, but it's a real attentiveness to see the cause of suffering that we, and once we know that, then we let go. Then our responses to conditioned world is like spontaneous. It's not coming from just reactivity, conditioned reactions, but there's a spontaneity coming out of awareness. What we do, how we act, what we say in the society, in the family, that comes from that rather than from just habitual, you know, emotional habits and reactivity. And I remember, you know, just watching my thinking mind, really examining just trying to solve doubts and problems through analysis, and I just became aware of there's no end to it. It just goes in cycles. You know, you're stuck in that realm of conditioned thinking, and you go around in a circle, and you come back to the same place, and there doesn't seem to be any way, even if you just try to think about solving the problems of the world, then you come up with good ideas and bright ideas of what to do and what the world should be like. But still, no matter how much we can rearrange the world so it becomes better, it's still, the basic ignorance is still there. So it's not going to just, you can't sustain a better world. Things go up and then they go down. So you can't, peak moment, you can't sustain it. So if you reach the peak, then there's not only one. You can't go higher, so you go down. You can't stay there. But the idealism always holds things on the peak. Cause that's the best. And so we idealize the best, and then compare the realities of this moment with the ideal of the best, and then what happens? We feel despair, anguish, depression, righteous indignation, because we can't keep it at that level. So, just recognizing that conditioned phenomena, it's changing all the time, and it's not, things just don't get better and better and better and better. And that's what we have, the illusion that we have oftentimes in the West is progress. We're just progressing. Democracy, freedom, technology, everything is just going to get better and better and better and better, progress. And that's what we want Iraq to do, and we want the Muslim world to join in the democratic process, so that the whole world will become better and better, better and better, better and better. But it's not like that. And you can see here in Britain, over the years, it has its peaks and then it goes down and goes up and down, and that's just normal. But then when it goes down, then we start hating the government and blaming them, and then we want a government that promises that it'll go up, progress the way it should be. So we're kind of continuing this. The political philosophies tend to try to convince us that if you vote for me, I can improve everything for you. And if I just stood on ticket of, that's the karma of England, I'd never get elected anyway.
Hatred is
never
conquered by hatred, but by non-hatred.
That's the cause and effect. Like karma is cause and effect. And so if you in the West, we seem to think that the end justifies the means. Having a war in order to give democracy to a country, the means is war, and the result will be democracy. Now, in terms of karma, you can't get democracy from a war. If, you know, the war is the result is more war, more hatred, more strife. And so, you know, on an ideal level, you can think, well, we'll just get rid of Saddam Hussein because he's the problem. And nobody would have minded that. Nobody liked him anywhere. So it wasn't like, you know, one couldn't feel sorry for Saddam Hussein. So it was one way, you know, you could kind of think, well, we'll just get rid of him and then we'll institute a democratic system. That's an ideal. You know, that's what one would like. But even killing Saddam Hussein is an evil act. You know, so, you know, just assassination. So, you know, in terms of karma. Now experimenting with, even though you think he deserves it, you know, on one level, you know, the act of killing is a heavy karmic action. And so they've killed almost everyone else but him. He's still alive. Now, in, you know, just seeing how in my own, just in the thinking process, if I think negative thoughts, if I start thinking, I don't like this, this shouldn't be, this person shouldn't act like this, the problem with Britain is, and this is not this, and the weather's too hot, or the weather's too cold, or then I get depressed. You know, because what am I doing? I'm creating all kinds of negative perceptions in consciousness. Now, the result of negative perceptions is you feel depressed or despair. It all looks hopeless. And that's just the way it is. That's the karma of thinking negatively. Then go to the other extreme, power of positive thinking. And so then you think life is wonderful, life is, all is love, and everybody is wonderful, and everything is, you know, no matter how the evil in the world, basically everybody's good, and you're thinking high-minded, inspiring, beautiful thoughts, then you'll feel quite happy. You know, you can get quite high on positive, like positive concepts. Now that's the way it is. The karma of thinking positively is happiness. The karma of thinking negatively is unhappiness. So then we think, well, I'll just think positively. Try to do that, especially when you've got a skeptical, cynical nature like I have. So when I meet people who are just too good to be true, I feel really irritated with them. I think it's like treacle or something. You just feel too much sugar is, you know, it's hard to digest. So then, so it's not a matter, you know, but it's certainly, you know, advisable to be optimistic and think good thoughts. You know, to recognize your own goodness, to appreciate the goodness in the society and the goodness of others, it certainly makes one's life happier and more pleasant. And so in monastic life, like in, you know, like Ajahn Chah, when I first met him, then he advised me to reflect on my own goodness. And I never thought of that before. And I was very much aware of my faults, but my own goodness, I never considered that for some reason. You know, I thought that was being dishonest, that honesty meant admitting what's wrong with you. And that conceit was, I'm I'm a very good, wonderful person. And, and so, that's how, you know, culturally that's the way I was conditioned. But then in terms of not to convince yourself that there's nothing wrong and you're a wonderful person, but, you know, you recognize, like, I kept thinking, why did I become a Buddhist monk? Because, you know, basically I love the good. I want truth, goodness, beauty. I appreciate this. I don't want to live in a world of ugliness and dishonesty and evil. You know, I couldn't stand living like that. You know, so there's this aspiration, longing for the beautiful, the good, the true. So this is good. Basically, I'm a good person then, because even though I don't always feel that way, basically, you know, this is what I'm aiming for. I wouldn't be a Buddhist monk if I was looking, you know, longing for evil things. You know, that's not a place. You don't join Buddhist monasteries to do that. So, I mean, I reflect, you know, appreciate my own goodness, my virtues. No, without patting myself on the back or exaggerating. Well, this gives you a sense of self-respect and appreciation for who you are, and then you're living a life of, you know, where you're an alms mendicant, so you're dependent on generosity from others for basic like food and shelter. So then in monastic meditations, we contemplate the goodness that people, you know, the generosity of the lay community, of what the offerings made. Like today, in a mealtime, the Sangha, the Dana, the offerings of food. This place is like a, you know, incredible display of most delicious foods brought to you know, for the Sangha. And you feel it's, you know, you reflect on the goodness of people, their generosity. And that, rather than just taking it for granted or just being critical of people, well, that brings a kind of joy into one's life. So, you know, monasticism can be a very joyful life, because you are, you know, in all these years I've been a monk, I've experienced so much goodness from other people. You know, people offering, you know, willing to provide what I need joyfully. You know, I don't have to kind of twist their arm or force anything. And so then you reflect on the goodness, you know, that you feel gratitude. And then the point is to be content, so you're not just thinking about what I want next, how to get something better. But your idea of monastic life is to be content with very little, so you aren't spending your life thinking of trying to always increase your standard and have better things. So you begin to notice that, because I'm conditioned, culturally conditioned, to be discontented. Like in the capitalist system, isn't it? Nothing in the American system advised me to be content with anything. It was all about, you know, the newest thing is better. What you have now is not good enough. So, you know, the whole capitalist system is based on making the population discontented. And so, like Buddhist monasticism is going against the whole capitalist system. It's a subversive force in this society. But contentment comes through, you know, you can't make yourself content just because you like the idea, but you begin to observe discontentment, the suffering of always wanting something better or not liking what you have, envying what some other monk, he has a better bowl than I do. You go through, it becomes, you know, you go through some of the most silly kind of things in monastic life, but the whole point is to be aware of it. You know, say, you know, it's like envy, jealousy in monastic life. Just around the, it's not a matter of, one monk's driving a Mercedes and I only have a BMW, but it's, it's around the size of your alms bowl or something. It gets down to the most ridiculous level, but it gives you a perspective on how the mind works, because envy is capitalism is a way of conditioning you to envy, keep up with the Joneses. If the neighbor has something better, you want something better than they have, and you're encouraged to do that. It's part of the cultural conditioning, and then observing how that process works. Then you have the insight of letting go of it, so you begin to feel content rather than feeling guilty about being discontented. Because then one can feel guilty. I should be content with my alms bowl. But it's not fair. I've been here longer, and this new monk was given a better alms bowl, and I shouldn't feel like that. I'm glad for him, happy for him. So you have a kind of internal conflict over this ridiculous thing. And so with awareness, you're just aware of the feeling, and you're not getting neurotic about it. Feeling you shouldn't feel this way. You're recognizing envy's like this, and not saying it. I shouldn't feel envy, but learning from envy feels like this. Wanting a better alms bowl than what I have is like this. So then from that way, it's actually when you're doing that, you're letting go, and then you find contentment then rather than as a result.